Wisconsin to near 50 degrees in western Missouri. Low temperatures overnight will range from the low 20s in central Iowa to the mid-40s in southwestern Kentucky. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain and sleet late this afternoon. Expect a high in the mid-30s. The wind will be light and out of the southeast. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain this evening. Then after midnight, there's a chance of light rain and light freezing rain. We'll see a low near 30. The wind light and from the east. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. There's a chance of light rain tomorrow morning, as well as a chance of light freezing rain early in the day. The high will be in the low 40s with the wind out of the northwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-20s. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 40s. Friday night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. And the outlook for Saturday and Saturday night, partly cloudy. Look for a high Saturday in the upper 30s and the low Sunday night in the low 20s. At noon central time, temperatures in Illinois and Indiana were in the 30s. Skies were cloudy. Some Illinois locations reporting some precipitation. At Rockford, 32 degrees, 36 degrees. At O'Hare and Bloomington, it was 31. Mattoon reported mixed precipitation and 31 degrees. Carbondale, light rain and 36 degrees. South Bend checked in with 31 degrees. It was 33 degrees at Indianapolis and Terre Haute, 34 at Lafayette. Champaign's Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 32 degrees, the dew point 27, the relative humidity 81%, the wind out of the east at 7, giving us a wind chill index of 26, and the barometric pressure 30.28, and steady. And at 12:39, 31 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. The practice of hydraulic fracturing, pumping fluid into underground rock to push up natural gas, has its detractors, especially among environmentalists. But it's becoming clear that whatever its drawbacks, fracking, as it's called, is producing a lot of gas, maybe too much, NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
Fracking was once a small part of the natural gas industry, a technique to get hard-to-reach deposits in underground shale. Then the technology improved, and the dinner bell rang. Everybody wanted in. Now there's so much gas on the market that the price is at a 10-year low. Michael Keyes is a vice president of Chesapeake Energy, one of the biggest shale gas producers.
A boom has only occurred over the last few years, and the market at first wasn't sure that it was real. But it is so real that it's actually depressing prices, and the view is that the price is going to remain low for a number of years going forward.
In fact, companies are storing a lot of gas instead of selling it. And now Chesapeake is pulling back from some wells. The company is moving half its drilling rigs from wells that produce dry gas, the stuff you use in your stove or water heater. Instead, they'll drill in places where there's also wet gas, stuff like ethylene, propylene, and butadiene. These are mostly used to make plastic or textiles, and they bring a higher price. Some of these wells also produce oil, also pricey right now. Economist Sarah Banaszak of the trade group America's Natural Gas Alliance says other energy companies are doing the same, but they aren't likely to abandon shale gas.
Companies that are here to produce natural gas are here for the long term. You know, there are, you know, micro adjustments in the path along the way, but I think they've made their investments and they're going to pursue that path.
Banaszak says fracking operations are pretty flexible.
One thing that is good about a lot of the unconventional production is the ability to sort of scale it up and down with changes in demand and supply.
For Chesapeake's Michael Keyes, it's a matter of waiting for more people, electric utilities or factories, to move to gas power.
You know, it's almost like the shale field of dreams. You know, we've built it, and now the demand will come.
A warm winter has also kept prices down, but analysts at the Federal Energy Information Agency say low prices could last for years, which could boost demand eventually. If it doesn't, there's already talk in the industry about liquefying America's surplus gas and exporting it overseas. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
When Waterbury, Vermont, was walloped by the remnants of Hurricane Irene, The small town sustained an estimated $9 million in damages to personal property and countless millions more in lost business revenue. 5 months later, Waterbury's future is uncertain. Vermont Public Radio's Lynn McRae reports.
Out on Main Street, a church bell still chimes daily. But daily life in Waterbury hasn't been the same since Tropical Storm Irene.
It's palpable. You can sense that it's not as vibrant as it was.
Bill Shepluck is Waterbury's municipal manager. He says about 200 properties in the village were hit by flooding, nearly a third of all its homes and businesses. But for residents, that's not the worst of it. For decades, 1,500 employees worked at the sprawling state office complex along one end of Main Street. But Irene's floodwaters inundated all 49 of the century-old red brick buildings. All but one of them was rendered uninhabitable. That meant almost all those workers had to go to temporary offices elsewhere. They still haven't returned. Bill Shepluck says the town felt the loss immediately. 1,500 people who were once in and out of restaurants, grocery stores, and dry cleaners are now gone.
You know, every job has a multiplier, so every dollar of payroll maybe translates into $7 or $8 or $12, and that dollar just gets circulated through a community.
More than half of Albert Caron's customers were state workers. His auto repair shop is just a block from the state office complex, and work has dropped off dramatically.
I have nothing scheduled for next week after. Near lunchtime, usually I can probably figure out anywhere between 8 and 10 walk-ins. Now I'll get one if I'm lucky.
The irony of Waterbury's situation is that the town was in tough straits 30 years ago when the state mental hospital occupied the buildings that have since been converted to the state office complex. It was that transformation from state hospital to state offices that triggered the town's renaissance. At Waterbury's Winter Farmers Market, Mark Hall says residents in this close-knit community have been trying to support village businesses.
The community is great. I mean, we do everything we can, but there's not enough of us to keep it going the way it was going before the flood.
The state has been studying whether it's financially feasible to renovate some of the aging buildings at the Waterbury complex so workers can return. The question now is, how long can the village wait? While many businesses struggle to hang on, people in town are fighting back. They've created Rebuild Waterbury, a nonprofit, to help push along the recovery process.
People are really, I think, committed to the community.
Amy Hoskins volunteers at the farmers market. She says before Irene, the town was just hitting its stride with the addition of things like a wine bar and a performing arts studio.
So it had become sort of a more thriving, lively place in the last few years, and to have Irene hit us when it did has really set us back.
Like many others in town, Hoskins is hopeful that Waterbury's resilience will carry it through this new challenge. Municipal manager Bill Shepluck sees it as a challenge the town will rise to.
You know, the old adage is you have to adapt or you die, and we're in a position where we have to accept there's going to be change.
Meanwhile, the town looks ahead to March. That's when state government expects to make decisions about whether any state workers can return to Waterbury and when. For NPR News, I'm Lynn McRae.
Americans traveling abroad are often stunned by the size of their mobile phone bill. Even if they aren't actively using their phone, they can rack up hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars in charges. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more, including some tips for consumers traveling abroad with their smartphones.
Los Angeles resident Lisa French thought she was being very careful when she took her smartphone on a trip to Japan.
I was advised not to make any phone calls, as phone calls overseas are very, very expensive.
So is text messaging, so she wasn't planning to do that either. She took note of an alert that popped up on her phone shortly after arriving in Japan, warning about possible data charges, but she wasn't planning to spend a lot of time online. And she says,
since I had traveled to Germany and Barcelona in the past, and I really only got maybe $30 or $40 more on my phone bill, I thought, oh, okay, it's only going to be about that much.
French was in for a big surprise. A few days into her trip, she checked her account online.
I found at the very bottom, very hard to read, that I had $462 in roaming charges. It was like a slap in the face.
Smartphones try to connect to the internet using Wi-Fi. It's often free, so you don't incur connection charges. But if the device doesn't pick up Wi-Fi, it will use a cellular network. And what runs up the bill is usually data. Mike Gikas, a senior editor at Consumer Reports, explains that even when you don't think you're using the phone, the device is running in the background, doing things like retrieving email, updating apps, and tracking your location.
And all of these things that happen nonchalantly on your phone, suddenly you'll be paying $5, $10, $15 a megabyte, which you can burn through in no time.
For example, location-based restaurant reviews, even ones you don't specifically ask for, could cost $2 or $3 each, and you might get half a dozen or more of them in a single day.
The trick for consumers is to be informed.
That's William Friedman, an official at the Federal Communications Commission. In 2010, the FCC proposed rules to get wireless carriers to provide timely and effective notice to consumers about these charges. The cell phone companies countered with a voluntary standard, and the federal government said okay.
Significantly, they agreed that these alerts would be provided free of charge, and there was no opt-in.
While some wireless carriers are already providing consumers with some notifications, carriers don't have to fully comply with the industry standard until next spring. But travelers don't have to wait. There are a number of steps you can take right now. One solution is to simply buy a prepaid local phone once you reach your destination. But if you can't part with your smartphone, John Walls of CTIA, the industry trade group, says you can turn off your phone's roaming function.
So that the only time that phone will work in a data capacity is in a Wi-Fi area that won't cost you.
You can also turn the device off completely and turn it on only if you know you're inside a Wi-Fi hotspot. You can also purchase a prepaid data plan. In short, says Walls, consumers have choices.
But you do have to be proactive and, in this case, go get it.
He urges travelers to call their wireless carrier's customer service line and check the provider's website before they leave home. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
The long-term future of public media in Central Illinois depends on the generosity of people like you who can make special gifts through their estate. Consider including WILL in your estate plan. Leave your own legacy and support what you love. Your attorney can help you put your wishes into proper form. For information on the WILL Legacy Circle, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or online at will.illinois.edu/support.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 25th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of Somerset Maugham, born in Paris, 1874. His father was in Paris as a lawyer for the British Embassy. When the boy was 8, his mother died from tuberculosis. His father died of cancer 2 years later. The boy was sent back to England into the care of a cold, distant uncle, a vicar. Maugham was miserable at his school. He said later, "I wasn't even likable. As a boy, I was withdrawn and unhappy." He became a doctor, and he practiced in the London slums. He was particularly moved by the women he encountered in the hospital where he delivered babies, and he was shocked by his fellow doctors' callous approach to the poor. He wrote, "I saw how men died. I saw how they bore pain. I saw what hope looked like, fear and relief. I saw the dark lines that despair drew on a face. I saw courage and steadfastness. I saw the gallantry that made a man greet the prognosis of death with an ironic joke because he was too proud to let those about him see the terror of his soul." When he was 23, Somerset Maugham published his first novel, Liza of Lambeth, about a working-class 18-year-old named Liza who has an affair with a 40-year-old married man named Jim, a father of 9. Jim's wife beats up Liza, who's pregnant and who miscarries and dies. The novel was a big success. Maugham made enough money to quit medicine, become a full-time writer. For many years, he made his living as a playwright, but eventually he became one of the most popular novelists in Britain. Novels including Of Human Bondage, the moon and sixpence, cakes and ale, and the razor's edge. Somerset Maugham, who said, "To acquire the habit of reading is to construct for yourself a refuge from almost all the miseries of life." It's the birthday of the poet Robert Burns, born Alloway, Scotland, 1759, son of a poor tenant farmer, brought up to work in the fields. When he was 15, he fell in love with a farm laborer named Nellie and wrote his first poem for her, "Oh, Once I Loved a Bonnie Lass." He tried to make a living as a farmer. He wasn't very good at it. He wanted to leave Scotland, sail to Jamaica, and he published a book of poems to raise money for his fare, a book entitled Poems Chiefly in the Scottish Dialect, and it was a success. It was praised by critics, and Burns dropped his plans for Jamaica, moved to Edinburgh, and became a beloved poet. And it's the birthday of Virginia Woolf, born in London, 1882, author of Mrs. Dalloway, To the Lighthouse, Orlando.